Greetings. You're listening to The Sower, a podcast of the Ciceronian Society. The Ciceronian Society is an interdisciplinary group of Christian scholars devoted to the study of tradition, place, and things divine. To learn more about us, our events, this podcast, our journal, Pietas, to sign up for our newsletter, please visit our website, ciceroniansociety.org. My name is Ethan Alexander Davey. I'm a professor of political science at Campbell University and a member of the board of directors of the Ciceronian Society. We will begin with a prayer. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. Amen. Glory to thee, our God, glory to thee. O heavenly King, the Comforter, the Spirit of Truth, who art everywhere present, and fillest all things, treasury of blessings, and giver of life, come and abide in us, and cleanse us from every impurity, and save our souls, O good one. Amen. What we have for you today is a recording of a panel that took place at the annual conference of the Academy of Philosophy and Letters on the 5th of June, 2025. Five contributors to my edited volume with Richard Avramenko, Aristocratic Voices, Forgotten Arguments About Virtue, Authority, and Inequality, presented material based on their chapters to an audience of about 100 people. More on that in a moment. But first, if you haven't heard of the Academy of Philosophy and Letters, let me say a few words about them, or I should say, about us, because I myself have been a member for several years, as have many other Ciceronians. The Academy, or APL for short, has an annual conference which in recent years is held in the first week of June in College Park, Maryland. APL also publishes a journal called Humanitas. You can learn more on the website, philosophyandletters.org. What I will tell you as an insider is that if you like the Ciceronian Society, you will probably like the Academy of Philosophy and Letters too. One of the reasons I wanted to have this panel on my book at APL is that four of our contributors are longtime APL members. This book might not have been possible without the connections that I made there. So if you have the opportunity, I would advise you to attend APL's annual conference in the first week of June. Now, to business. I had planned to add commentary at both ends of the recording, but I realized that that would end up being too much. So I'll just say a few words by way of introduction. At the end of the panel, a long queue of young men formed and asked many very discerning questions. We have not included the question and answer portion. I'll just mention that some of the young men asked, quite reasonably, how can an aristocratic form of government be relevant today, especially when we consider that the aristocrats we know from history were hereditary, and that modern politics, and especially the conservative movement today, is populist? One of our contributors, Professor Michael Federici, made the point that there are different types of democratic regimes. There is a difference, for instance, between a mass democracy and a democracy in which the popular will is subject to constitutional checks and balances. I just want to suggest, very briefly, one other way of looking at this question. And to do that, I'm going to read quotations from two famous men. The first is from Edmund Burke's Reflections on the Revolution in France. Burke says, "Believe me, sir, those who attempt to level never equalize. In all societies consisting of various descriptions of citizens, some description must be uppermost. The levelers therefore only change and pervert the natural order of things. They load the edifice of society by setting up in the air what the solidity of the structure requires to be on the ground. The associations of tailors and carpenters, of which the Republic of Paris, for instance, is composed, cannot be equal to the situation into which, by the worst of usurpations, an usurpation on the prerogatives of nature, you attempt to force them. So that's obviously an aristocratic voice. Some description of citizens will always be on top, Burke tells us. And it is crucial that the right sort of citizens be on top. Not everyone is fit to be at the top of the social hierarchy. Now, the second quotation is from the 17th century English soldier and politician Thomas Rainborough. Historians call Rainborough a leveller, but I don't believe he ever called himself that. This is probably his most famous statement. He says, "For really I think that the poorest he that is in England hath a life to live, as the greatest he. And therefore truly, sir, I think it's clear that every man that is to live under a government ought first by his own consent to put himself under that government, and I do think that the poorest man in England is not at all bound in a strict sense to that government that he hath not had a voice to put himself under. And I am confident that when I have heard the reasons against it, something will be said to answer those reasons, insomuch that I should doubt whether he was an Englishman or no, that should doubt of these things." So there we have a democratic voice. The poor man has a life to live too, and so he should also have a voice in any government that presumes to govern him. I think both of these men were telling us something true about politics. I've often thought that I would one day write a book about an imaginary republic, and in the city square there would be statues to both of these men, to Burke and Rainborough, to represent these two political truths. The challenge has ever been to combine the government of the few with the government of the many, that is to say, to combine aristocracy and democracy. This is the idea of the mixed regime that Plato, Aristotle, Cicero, and many others wrote about. It's a form of government in which both the elite and the many are able to speak in their own voices as they transact government business. In many ancient and medieval constitutions, the aristocrats and the democrats had their own separate assemblies in the legislature, so that each class would in fact be able to speak in its own voice. Perhaps this is a model that is worth reconsidering today. And now, the panel.
My name is Ethan Alexander Davy. I teach political science at Campbell University. I'm also one of the editors of the book we're talking about this afternoon. Before I introduce the panel, just to show you, there are actually two of these books. And if anyone's taking pictures, maybe would this be a good shot? But two of these books, the one we're talking about today is called Aristocratic Voices, Forgotten Arguments About Virtue, Authority, and Inequality. The one we published a few years ago is called Aristocratic Souls in Democratic Times. They are both prohibitively expensive because academic publishing is a racket. So I would recommend you either get your university library to purchase copies or rob a wealthy enemy and use the loot to buy copies on Amazon. All right, so I'll introduce our panel, and I'll go through their names, and then I'll introduce the topic. So we have Matthew Cantorino, who will start this fall at University of Austin, teaching there.
Dallas.
Dallas. Well, you see how good I am at this kind of thing. The University of Dallas. All right, Luke Sheehan, I know he's at Duquesne University. Don't correct me on that one. The title of his paper is Authority, Hierarchy, and the Social Bond in the Aristocratic Thought of Robert Nisbet. Let me go back for a minute. Matthew's paper, Henry Adams, Aristocracy in an American? Question mark. Right, then we have Michael Federici, teaches at Middle Tennessee State University. His paper is Irving Babbitt on Democracy and Leadership. And we have Michael Harding, who teaches at Montgomery College. The title of his paper is Against the Tarantulas, Nietzsche on Aristocracy. All right, so the theme of this conference is the forms that fit. Our volume of essays is not about that specifically, but this supplies an occasion to point out something obvious. Historically, there were two classes, or it's better to say two estates, that developed and maintained the forms that gave order and meaning to social life. I speak, of course, of the clergy and the nobility. In positing this as an argument, I'm reminded of Chesterton's prophecy at the end of his 1905 book, Heretics. Fires will be kindled to testify that two and two make four. Swords will be drawn to prove that leaves are green in summer. The historical claim is indisputable, but I would also argue that without such classes or their equivalents, it is not possible to restore or maintain on a broad basis the sorts of forms and manners we are defending here. So I'll give a couple examples from my essays in those two books. First, concerning the clergy. The Russian Orthodox writer Konstantin Leontief, and by the way, I also appreciate thinkers no one has ever heard of. He makes this remark about marriage. He notes that not all marriages are happy, and his own, for instance, was not. But he says this, "The poetry of marriage and family is surprisingly exalted when each step of family life, each custom, each aspect of the nurture of the children is illuminated by the idea of orthodoxy and adorned by the sweet traditions of the national shrine." The German Protestant writer, another unknown, Wilhelm Riehl, describes the custom of peasants and noblemen in 19th century Germany. He says that the peasant not only brings his entire household to the church for communion, baptisms, and marriages, but also expects private ministrations to his family by clergy in his home. As an example of this tendency, he notes the 16th century custom of Protestant parents bearing to Christ a baby still in the womb through a ceremonial act of prayer. Now, as for noblemen, they would have a member of the clergy on their estate to minister privately to the entire family. The forms, the rites, the rituals were maintained in the home in part because of the presence in the home of clergy. Riehl contrasts peasants and nobles with the more individualistic members of the middle class who may attend church once a week, but would regard that kind of involvement of clergy in family life that Leontief and Riehl describe as, quote, an intolerable clerical imposition on one's personal freedom. Leontief and Riehl describe much more vividly what members of APL already know from Tocqueville, that is, the spirit of equality and individualism that dissolves the forms. Leontief, in particular, also argued that the freedom sought by the emancipators from tradition is illusory. Leontief never minced words. He said this about the development of individual freedom in the West. Quote, "Nobody wants to see that in the West, the farther things go, the more free it is, and the more free it is, the worse and weaker it is. Even this personality, the supposedly emancipated personality, the farther he goes, the emptier he is. The more he is emancipated from various communities, guilds, and estates, and from the state, the more dependent he is on the prejudices and the mediocrity of public opinion, and the more of a weakling and a nullity he is." So from Leontief's point of view, the move toward emancipation from traditional authorities is actually degrading and dehumanizing. All these supposedly free individuals just become subject to what he calls, quote, that thousand-headed, feeble-minded hydra, public opinion. In his time, this was a small group of highly literate, progressive, opinion makers, the intelligentsia. Now we would call it the mass media. If it is rare today for members of clergy to have a presence in people's homes, feeble-minded entertainers and journalists are present in people's homes all the time through TV and the internet. This despotism of public opinion, with its tentacles spread throughout public and private life, shapes individuals into vapid ideologues and clownish global consumers. Now concerning the nobility. According to Riel, the old nobility supported the nation in at least three ways: as a defender and the prime embodiment of the principle of social differentiation, that's one; two, of family consciousness; and three, of national historical consciousness. First, the nobility, he says, is best defined as an estate of social barriers. The nobles are, in effect, the founders of the principle of social differentiation. This began in the early Middle Ages when the great nobles, on the basis of their political and military might, established the right of the drawbridge. The drawbridges were then literal ones, associations of nobles and their vassals built and acquired castles, walled off their land with moats and drawbridges. This, together with settled relations of fraternity and mutual obligation, enabled nobles to constitute a little world of their own, which became a splendid basis in miniature for the corporative structure of society, of the society to which it gave rise. In short, the nobility was the first guild. All later guilds, with their exclusive privileges for members, their mutual obligations, their consciousness and habit-shaping rights, are modeled on the nobility. Second, the nobility, according to Riel, also should serve as a shining example of family consciousness. The family consciousness of a noble is distinct from that of a peasant or from that of a burgher, in that it is has a much longer history and often has a relation to public events. The family consciousness of the noble is more historical. Another quote: coats of arms provide a visible token of the extent to which this consciousness of family has become a matter of history. Collateral branches discover evidence of their common family ties in this heraldic symbolism. Admiration for the deeper and more illustrious family consciousness of nobles inspires a respect for family consciousness as such, and a desire among humbler orders to seek something like it in their own families. Third, the beauty and welfare of a differentiated society depend on the cultural and economic paternalism of the nobility. Nobles, more than any other group, will acknowledge their duty to keep alive the historical consciousness of the race. The nobility itself is a living piece of history and is drawn to the study of history out of sheer class interest. Its members, therefore, would use their votes in the upper chamber of the legislature to protect the traditions of the nation. A genuine nobility has that combination of power, wealth, and respect for traditional culture, and a paternalist mindset necessary to arrest the leveling and homogenizing tendencies of the modern age. Nobles acknowledge their special responsibility to preserve the achievements of past civilization against the barbarous destruction of everything unique and historic in society. And that last bit is a quote from Riem as well. So, obviously we still have churches, seminaries, and monasteries, although we've already discussed at this conference some of the problems with them. But it's possible, certainly, to train more clergy and to revitalize the churches and to get more people involved in them and more involved in the lives of our citizens. On the other hand, the hereditary nobilities of Europe and the natural aristocracy of the United States are mostly gone. So restoring the nobility would be a lot harder to do than revitalizing the clergy. But past generations have left libraries of manuals for those who would adopt the manners and habits of nobility. So I'll also point out chapter 5 of our book by Derek Turner on Sir Thomas Eliot, who wrote one of the more famous courtesy books of, in that case, the 16th century. For many generations, these books were written to teach, especially young men, what their manner should be. If you are going to hold a position of power, how ought you to behave? And there, so there are generations of these handbooks out there, that many of them are still in print. And I could also point out to you one that might be more familiar, George Washington's Rules of Civility and Decent Behavior in Company and Conversation. That's very short. You could start with that one. So the literature exists from which the forms and habits of gentlemen could be reacquired and modeled for the rest of the population. My recommendation, outlandish recommendation for the United States, would be to establish associations on the model of the Society of the Cincinnati, which, to my surprise, still exists. And those who understand that allusion also probably know that when Thomas Jefferson heard about the Cincinnati, he flipped out and wrote a series of panicky letters to Washington about this group, who he said was going to reestablish hereditary monarchy and aristocracy in the United States. Jefferson had some very good ideas, for instance, his conception of federalism, but he had some bad ideas too, and since he's no longer around to kick up a fuss, and since we've seen most of his bad ideas play out in our history, maybe it's time to turn back to the project of the original Cincinnati. Thank you.
Thank you. So I'll start by talking about my chapter in the book, which is on Henry Adams, as an American. And in some ways, this is perhaps a little bit of a strange place to start. So we're not talking about a European, we're not talking about an actual titled aristocrat, somebody who had some kind of legal privileges because of his name, but who, of course, is that Adams. He's from the Adams family in America. He's the grandson of John Quincy, the great-grandson of the founding father John Adams. At the same time, Henry lived 1838 to 1918, so that kind of gives you a sense of his life, and there was immense change in the American everything. I mean, politics, economics, technology during the course of his life. He's also sort of the last Adams of any kind of prominence. So he and his wife did not have children. And you know, so there's a lot of interpretation of him. He's a brilliant mind. He's a brilliant writer. He wrote a whole lot of different things. He wrote histories of the United States. He wrote novels. He wrote a kind of sort of autobiography of his own life called The Education of Henry Adams, which received the Pulitzer. It was published posthumously. So he's an immensely talented kind of Renaissance man, but he never entered elected politics. And so there's a lot of debate about how to interpret him. He's deliberately kind of ironic and cryptic in many places. You have to read him kind of carefully. But I want to sort of get at some of the literature. I'm not going to bore you with all of the scholarship and all the footnotes, but I want to kind of trace some trends in the literature about Henry Adams and how to think about him, and then I want to put forward another interpretation of him. In brief, my interpretation is, as you might have guessed from the title of this volume, that he should be thought of as an aristocratic voice. He should be thought of as an aristocratic soul. That he's not a Democrat, as that lowercase d, as that term is used. And so a lot of the literature about him, though, does not come to this conclusion. In the last 25 years or so, I would divide a lot of the literature about Adams into two camps, and they revolve around what's called democratic theory. So how does Adams fit into the theories of democracy? How can he either help us support democracy, or how does he oppose democracy? Is he either for or against it? And there's really two schools of thought here. One I would call the sour grapes interpretation of Henry Adams. And there are a lot of different writers who fall into this category. And then the secret friend interpretation of Henry Adams. So he either hates the modern world, he rejects democracy, he's sour grapes about it because he didn't get elected to a position. He never sought office. But his family is no longer respected, and so everything he does is sort of in the words of one scholar, the records, his writings are the records of the tantrum of a frustrated individual will. He's frustrated. He's throwing temper tantrums because people like him are no longer elevated to the positions they deserve. There's something to the sour grapes interpretation in the sense that Adams is not a booster of democracy. He's not an enthusiast of it. He's got a lot of critical remarks about democracy and modernity more broadly. But I want to say something to this interpretation, because it's very common. Even people who have not read Henry Adams but know him or know something about him often think, oh, yes, a brilliant guy, interesting writer, but really pessimistic, really really sort of, you know, sour about the whole thing. So are his books just the tantrum of a frustrated individual will? Or perhaps he just doesn't believe in democracy in any kind of way. He can't even accept it. One scholar says, goes so far as to argue that Henry Adams does not accept the American creed of equality as founded the Declaration of Independence and as rearticulated by Abraham Lincoln, that he abandons his ancestors' quote fidelity to America's revolution principles. So he's really anti-American, according to one scholar. I would say something about this. I mean, yes, true. He doesn't spend time in his many writings articulating the political philosophy of the Declaration of Independence. He does not talk very much about Lincoln. What he says is kind of ambiguous about him. But I would sort of suggest, so what? That doesn't mean that he's opposed to the Declaration of Independence. That's a kind of overdrawn conclusion. Just because he doesn't state things in the sort of dogmatic way that certain scholars think they ought to be stated, just because his moods are sort of melancholic, doesn't mean he's against America. It doesn't mean he's against the whole modern world. I mean, he's skeptical. He's critical of it. So let me try to sort of defend what sometimes is taken as his sour mood or his pessimistic mood. Adams is very concerned about democracy and about the modern world in general because he is very concerned that the person is being effaced from history, and that not only persons like him, persons of name, but all persons are at risk of being obliterated. Genuine individualism, genuine human excellence, aesthetic refinement are being replaced, he is worried, by conformity, by pettiness, and by ugliness. In The Education, for example, he talks about his concern that the American Republic is turning into a mass democracy. I mean, there's democracy and there's democracy. As Dr. Federici will talk about with Irving Babbitt probably in a few minutes, there's democracy and there's democracy. There's a kind of democracy directed toward the right ends, and there's a kind of mass democracy. There's a Rousseauian democracy. So Adams is concerned that democracy is going to turn into mass democracy. It's going to efface all kind of human excellence and aesthetic beauty. The question of his mood, I think, is worth reconsidering, too. He can be grave. He can perhaps even be melancholic, although he's light and funny in other places, too, by the way. He's not always dour. But if he's serious, if he's grave sometimes, perhaps that's the mark of a serious person. Perhaps his melancholy is the mark of somebody with a great depth of soul. Abraham Lincoln had melancholy. It was because he had great depth of soul. It may be the mood of someone attuned to reality in a way that's more profound than many of their contemporaries, who live a kind of ephemeral democratic life and just concerned about what's happening tomorrow and making money. Perhaps this is somebody with depth of soul. There are many in the modern world, as Adams says, who cannot even understand that they are bored. His writing style may also be seen as an example of his aristocratic temperament or his aristocratic soul. The first words of the preface to his book, The Education of Henry Adams, invoke Jean-Jacques Rousseau. The name is immediately followed by a quotation from the Confessions, in which Rousseau tells his readers that in his work, quote, I have shown myself as I was, contemptible and vile when I was so, good, generous, and sublime when I was so. I have unveiled my interior, such as thou thyself hast seen it. That's Rousseau. Immediately, in an amusing put-down, Adams notifies his readers that this kind of model of self-disclosure is not appropriate for his work. That, quote, as Adams says, even the humblest teacher hides, if possible, the faults with which nature has generously embellished us all, as it did Jean-Jacques. Thinking, as most religious minds are apt to do, that the Eternal Father may not feel unmixed pleasure at our thrusting under his eyes the least agreeable details of his creation. Adams is saying here that, you know, this is his, even in his autobiography, the goal is not to sort of reveal his real self and then broadcast it to the world unfiltered. That's a very mass democratic attitude. In fact, even a good autobiography, like, let's say, Augustine's Confessions instead of Rousseau's, is careful about what it selects. And it's not to lie to people, it's not to hide things from people, but it's to get a true portrait of what this person was. And so Adams is concerned to do that. He's not trying to simply broadcast himself. And so if he's critical of that kind of tendency, well, I think there's an aristocratic element to that concern. But it also doesn't mean that he's, you can't draw a conclusion out of that he's against any sort of like elective politics or the Declaration of Independence. He's worried about these trends in mass democracy. There are other scholars, I'm not going to spend time on this, but instead of saying, oh, he's all sour grapes, they instead kind of invert it and say, he's actually a secret friend of democracy. He loves democracy. Well, no, I don't think that's right either. In the words of one scholar who's in this vein, it says, no one had more faith in democracy than Henry Adams. Really, no one? I can think of quite a few people who had more faith in democracy. So we don't have to make overdrawn conclusions. Again, you know, I understand the desire to kind of push back against the negative interpretation of him, but then you overstate the positive. I wouldn't say he's a secret friend of democracy. I would say, again, he's an aristocratic voice. Let me just read just a couple of quotes, for example, from his letters. And again, it's, you know, you've got to read more than just his main works. I mean, it helps to read his letters. It helps to read everything he wrote. He was in Italy in his 20s when Italian unification was occurring. And he actually met Garibaldi in Naples at one point. And he was not impressed with him. And he said of the red shirts, he said, where is the Sicilian nobility and the gentleman who ought to take the lead in a movement such as this? So he was annoyed by the rampaging of the mob. He didn't like the rampaging of the mobs. He said there needs to be leaders, there need to be elites who are leading a movement. I mean, again, note what he's saying there. He's not saying, I support restoring the monarchy over Italy. He doesn't say that. He says if such a movement is to occur, it needs to have well-formed leaders. It needs to have elites who are formed to lead and to refine this kind of movement, not the rampaging mobs that I see. In a letter to his brother, Charles Adams, he says that what we need to do is, quote, find a national set of young men like ourselves to better or start new influences in politics, not only in politics, but in literature, in law, in society. So again, he's not saying throwing out everything. He's saying we need new leaders. We need better elites. This concern appears throughout his career, from his 20s until the time he dies in the early 1910s, and in a lot of his other writings as well. The education, you can see this, but you see it in his letters, in his other works. He's also very critical of other solutions that he sees as kind of just reinforcing the problem of mass democracy. So progressivism, for example. Progressivism as a movement in some ways does acknowledge there are some real problems with what's happened to American democracy. But the problem with progressivism is it's a kind of mass democratic solution to a mass democratic problem. It does not focus on cultivating leaders and cultivating persons of quality to lead the society. And so he says of progressivism, that at one point in the letter he's writing about Wilson and Teddy Roosevelt and David Lloyd George, and he calls progressivism a busted delusion. He says it's a technocratic solution to a human problem. He says in the education, he's concerned that Americans are going to just become thought of as Adams, it will play on his name, the A-T-O-M-S, and that's a bad thing, that Americans shouldn't just be people massed about central powerhouses and governed as if they were Adams. So, you know, again, this is challenging a lot of the interpretations of him, but I think, you know, when you pay attention to him, and I'm not even going to say you have to read him esoterically or something to find this, I think it's there if you just read him. And you know, there's scholarship that's better and there's scholarship that's worse, but I think when you read him with an open mind and you sort of can see, okay, he's got real concerns, but he's also got some real insights here. And, you know, one more letter from him to his brother. He says that with the way the democracy is going, the fact that the technology is just going to be embraced and used by the masses, he says this could lead to all kinds of things. Some of them could be great, some of them could be horrible. He says to his brother that, quote, man might cruise in space or he might blow up the world. Well, we need leaders to help us make that choice and to help refine and enlarge the public's opinions on these things. And, you know, it's a prophetic letter. And again, his concerns there, I think, are not at all crankish, are not at all eccentric. These are the kind of concerns you heard in a lot of late 19th century thinkers. You see them in Nietzsche. You see them in Dostoevsky. The idea that there could be some real catastrophe if, you know, the kind of proper formation of leaders and their souls is not conducted. Okay, how much time do I have left? I have a wrap up.
I know. Probably talk
about it. Just one or two more minutes. So I think there's more here, but what does he want then? I mean, what is his solution? And how, you know, he doesn't put forward a program. You know, again, the emphasis is on kind of cultivating individuals of character, elites to kind of lead a society. And what I point to in the article is, as I say, I think if you look at a lot of his writings, what he's concerned about is, in particular, to cultivate a kind of authentic cosmopolitan disposition in these leaders. And I say authentic because there's a kind of pseudo-cosmopolitanism that can be taken. But an authentic cosmopolitanism, leaders who can sort of understand their country and he was unquestionably, Adams was unquestionably loyal to his country, to the United States of America. He never pined for, to be a citizen of another country. He never took the option of T.S. Eliot or something, became a British subject. He never did any of that. He was an American through and through. But his answer is that we need leaders with a kind of authentic cosmopolitanism who can understand their country and appreciate it, and understand and appreciate their time and place, but also transcend it. Because any truth, it's always partial. There's always a kind of broader human experience that requires people who to understand it and to bring it down to the present, and to kind of form bridges to mediate between this broader human experience, you might call it the Western tradition. Adams, it goes even broader than that and looks at a kind of global humanities kind of approach. But you need these kind of sensitive elites to sort of manage this. And his concern is that if we don't cultivate the right kind of leaders, we are going to head for a blow-up. And we've already had blow-ups. The whole history of the 20th century, I think, bears out a lot of his concerns. We're not done yet. We're not through that yet. And so I think his concerns about mass democracy, about these kind of things, are just as relevant today, if not more, than they were maybe 30 or 40 years ago. I mean, in some ways, someone said earlier, I think we're sort of back to a lot of these 19th century questions. And so his concerns are really, I think, prescient. So as far as Americans go, I would submit that Adams has an aristocratic soul and is an aristocratic voice. He's, of course, not a titled aristocrat. We don't have those, we know. But I think that characterization is a better fit for him, just as a matter of just classifying who he is and what he's about, than trying to slot him into democratic theory and say he's either pro or anti-democracy. I think aristocratic is a better label and one with a longer lineage. So, thank
you. Hello again. Many of the accounts of the decline of community fail to appreciate the role of authority. For example, Harvard professor Robert Putnam is famous for his work chronicling the decline of American political, civic, religious, and professional associations in his classic Bowling Alone, The Collapse and Revival of American Community. He is indicative of the present tendency to desire community, but by the egalitarian terms set by liberalism and democracy, failing to take into account the warnings of Alexis de Tocqueville and Robert Nisbet that the egalitarian pretension militates against the primary glue of the social bond, authority. Writing in The Upswing, Putnam and co-author Shailen Romney Garrett write, between 1870 and 1920, civic inventiveness reached a crescendo, unmatched in American history, not merely in terms of numbers of clubs, but in the range and durability of the newly founded organizations. Half of all the largest mass member organizations in American history were founded in the decades between 1870 and 1920. But Putnam, writing 170 years after Tocqueville and at the turn of the new century, notes with despondency that this impulse has declined, Americans no longer constantly unite, in Tocqueville's terms, for a variety of purposes. While thin, single-stranded, surf-by interactions are commonplace, associations of the like praised by Tocqueville and Democracy in America and Putnam and Bowling Alone are not. Putnam attributes the decline in substantive associational engagement to a decline in we-ness. By this, Putnam and Garrett mean that individuals used to think in broad political and egalitarian terms. We're all Americans, we're all in this together. This resulted in Putnam and Garrett's words, greater economic equality, more cooperation in the public square, a stronger social fabric, and a growing culture of solidarity, end quote. But around mid-century, middle of the 20th century, this we-ness shifts in thinking in individualist terms, I-ness, as they put it, especially since 1970, resulting in the marked decline in associations that we have seen since then. This account, while compelling in some ways, fails to provide a fundamental framework of the substance of the bond between individuals, that which connected individuals and the vibrant associations in the early 19th century and at the turn of the 20th was not equality, but authority. Tocqueville remarks that American associations are voluntary, but that an authority structure emerges immediately upon associating. It is not an outside authority, which Americans innately reject, but an inner structure of authority emerging from the act of associating itself. The structure is no less binding because it is voluntary. Tocqueville perceived that Americans implicitly recognize their democratic equality results in weakness. In a democracy, in Tocqueville's words, all citizens are independent and weak. They can hardly do anything by themselves, and no one among them can compel his fellows to lend their help. So they fall into impotence if they do not learn to help each other freely. End quote. Americans' penchant for association means falling into a structure of varied function and authority to get things done. As the people assemble and discuss what to do, they fall into a variety of functions, including, as Tocqueville points out, an executive power, an ability to enforce the decision of the group. Tocqueville explains, the association gathers the efforts of divergent minds into a network and vigorously pushes them toward a single, clearly indicated goal. The authority of the group as a whole over the assembly of individuals is like, in Tocqueville's words again, a separate nation within a nation, a government within a government. This vital element of authority, voluntarily submitted to and arising spontaneously from the very structure of association, but an authority nonetheless, Tocqueville recognizes as essential to the effectiveness of voluntary associations. Robert Nisbet, Tocqueville's greatest 20th century disciple, argues that the decline of communities widely observed in the Western world is a decline of this authority. In his 1970 textbook, The Social Bond, Nisbet writes, any social order is a tissue of authorities. In contemporary society, these authorities range from the mild and provident authority of a mother over her infant to the absolute, unconditional, and imprescribable authority of the national state. Some system or pattern of authority is involved in any continuing social aggregate. The moment two or more persons find themselves in a relationship that involves, in whatever degree of informality or formality, the distribution of responsibilities, duties, needs, privileges, and awards, a pattern of authority is present. Authority is the glue that holds the individual atoms and the molecules of the community. When we think about most of our activity, it involves obeying rules and meeting expectations set by institutions and persons. Even those in open rebellion against some manifestation of authority are only obeying the marching orders of another form of authority. The teenager who rebels against parental authority is not marching to the beat of his own drum, but to that of a peer group. Those in revolt against political authority are following the orders of the revolutionaries, generally gathered in an elite of some sort. The Protestant Reformation did not pit liberty against authority, but the authority of Scripture against the authority of the papacy. The French Revolution set the authority of the people, manifested in the National Assembly and the Committee on Public Safety, against the authority of the Crown and Church. No matter what, Nisbet notes, people obey authorities of some sort, even when, or especially when, they are disobeying others. It is from the perspective of social authority that Nisbet criticized the modern state. The intrusion of political power into realms of traditional authority, as well as the recession of spheres of authority under external stress that invites revolution, was the very setting for the rise of the modern political order. Traditional authority, residing in aristocracy, town, church, family, and neighborhood, were undermined by two revolutions, the industrial and the democratic. Technological advances and the growth of the modern state struck blow after blow against these communal relations. And while the Industrial Revolution was not entirely due to political intrusions, it was often accompanied by the actions of the state. Industrialism brought attention to the plight of the working class. While the rich and poor have been with us always, the new working class was subservient and its livelihood tenuous, in a way more degrading than medieval agricultural society, where a complex of values such as honor knit peasants to each other and nobility to peasantry, and where a vast array of interlocking social groups, guilds, towns, feudal relations, religious orders, and the like, provided communal support, the relation between men and the new order was solely on what Carlyle described as the cash nexus. Cash as relation was no psychological or social match for the communal bonds of kinship, neighborhood, and religion, or the security of real property. The destruction of the latter was especially devastating to the functional value of associational authorities. The Industrial Revolution changed the relationship between man and property. Property, previously the indispensable basis of family, church, state, and all their major groups in society, was itemized, split apart, and made merely a matter of division among individuals. The effect of this development upon the social order was enormous. While the cause was in part economic, the change in conceptions and role of property was largely the result of a change in property laws. Primogeniture and entail, which kept property within the family, were abolished and transferred to the individual alone. Previously, estates could continue intact through centuries. Now they were divided every generation. The corporate idea of property was abolished not just for the family, but for all institutions. Property belonged to individuals as shares, not to corporate bodies. Such an impersonal arrangement softened the relationship between property and individuals and could not generate individual loyalty or affection. Furthermore, no longer could the essential institutions of the social order exist upon an independent economic basis. Their very existence made economically tenuous, they were severely hindered in their ability to aid their members economically, thus garnering loyalty or to exercise authority over them. The Democratic Revolution, beginning with the French Revolution but continuing in political consequence nearly everywhere, brought changes similar to those of the Industrial Revolution. The goal of the French revolutionaries was explicitly social and moral reconstruction that would involve church, family, property, and other institutions. The goal of these reforms was to transfer authority from a plethora of institutions, corporations, associations, family, and church to the centralized state. Nisbet identifies Rousseau as the key to understanding this development. The authority of these social institutions, what Rousseau called partial associations, disrupts the unity of the general will. To limit their influence upon the thinking of individuals, a centralized political power must stifle all social authorities that threaten to undermine the unity of the political community. Following the outline of Rousseau's general will, the revolutionaries conceived the state as a form of fraternity that made all older forms seem obsolete and discriminatory. Especially effective in individualizing and politicizing traditional social aggregates was the idea of equality. Nisbet shared Burke's and Tocqueville's trepidation about this individualizing and politicizing idea. From power conceived as liberation, it was but a short step to power conceived as equality, in his words. He further writes, "Equality has a built-in revolutionary force, lacking in such ideas as justice or liberty. For once the ideal of equality becomes uppermost, it becomes insatiable in its demands. It accelerates and exacerbates the individualization and politicization processes. Under egalitarianism, individuals may not have any authorities that are over them or hierarchies of which they are a part, or individuals are not truly equal. This vision of equality can be achieved only if a central power, the state, intervenes to undermine hierarchies and to limit authority. Equality as an essential aspect of the democratic order would prove a social asset, wearing through traditional social bonds, not just those attached to medieval social structures of aristocracy, kinship, and guild, but of also new voluntary associations." Nisbet describes the wedding of equality with political power as constituting a new science of despotism. He writes, "What gives the new science of despotism its peculiar effectiveness is indeed its liaison with humanitarianism. Individualization of persons from traditional social authorities through the exercise of centralized political power acquires a moral aura because of its appeal to equality." Nisbet describes his collection of remedies for what ails the modern world as the restoration of authority. Without authority and function, return to a plethora of social groups, there can be no true freedom and no true community. Nisbet outlined several elements of a pluralistic society that recognized the importance of social groups. At the heart of his idea for reforms is getting us to a place where associations are to be autonomous as to their essential function, relating to the revival of the social order. So that means they complete with authority and hierarchy. Nisbet writes, "Authority, any society, any association must have. It is simply the structure of the association. But the sole possibility of personal freedom and cultural autonomy lies in the maintenance of a plurality of authorities in any society. So long as there are other and competing authorities, so long as man has even the theoretical possibility of removing himself from any that for him has grown oppressive and of placing himself within the framework of some other associative authority, it cannot be said that his freedom has suffered." End quote. Thank you.
Good afternoon, everyone. This is a large panel and a round table. And in the interest of the spirit of APL meetings, which are intended to be conversational, I will keep my comments brief. And informal. I'm giving formal comments on a panel tomorrow. And I also want to note, as somebody who has attended APL meetings for many, many years, that I never thought I would say something like this. But for those of you who are having trouble finding seats, there's an entire empty row right here in the front if you're looking for a place to sit. That's number one. Number two is there's no truth to the rumor, as I've heard already, that there is an inverse relationship between the size of the attendance at an APL meeting and the size of the cups. So in the spirit of continuing conversation, which means that we try to carry over conversations from panel to panel and from panels to informal meals and get-togethers, I will tell you a little bit about the chapter in the book that I've written on Irving Babbitt, but I also have noticed that there are a great number of younger people at the meeting this year, and so I want to try and do something to entice them into conversation. So first, I was making a copy of the conference schedule at my home institution, and I happened to have a colleague who was waiting to use the copying machine, and he asked me what I was doing. I told him I was going to a conference. He asked me about the conference. He said, "What's your panel on?" And I pointed to my panel, "Aristocratic Voices, Forgotten Arguments About Virtue, Authority, and Inequality." And he said, "Oh, you're getting together with your reactionary pals again, huh?" He would not understand the point that I'm about to make, which is a very Babidian point, but I think many in the room will. This is not a panel of reactionaries. And why is that? Because I believe the book is written, and certainly my chapter is written, in the spirit of Edmund Burke. And that is that our objective is not simply to imitate the past, as a traditionalist would, but rather to reconstitute the past, to reconstitute old forms and adapt them to new circumstances. That's point number one. Point number two. On the previous panel, there was a short conversation in the question and answer period about power and limits on power and the corrupting effect of power. And I want to make a couple of points that are related to both Babbitt and the conference in general. One is, most of us know Lord Acton's famous dictum, that power tends to corrupt and absolute power corrupts absolutely. But one of the things that's often missed when people quote Lord Acton is the tends part of the first part, which is to say, power does not always corrupt. It tends to corrupt. What always corrupts is absolute power. And the distinction, I think, is an important one, and one that was known well to Babbitt, who was an admirer of Lord Acton. And that is that there are ways that power can be constrained so that it can be exercised in accordance with the good. And generally, those two ways are through institutions. We might think of that as institutional forms. And the second thing is virtue or character. One of the things that Babbitt emphasizes throughout his work, but especially in the book that I focused on in my chapter, which is Democracy and Leadership. For those of you who are younger and maybe at your first APL meeting, you maybe have never heard of Irving Babbitt, and some of the presentations so far may or may not be of interest to you. But for those of you who know Christopher Nolan's Batman, and there may be more of you that know that than Irving Babbitt, I would submit to you that Christopher Nolan's portrayal of Batman is very Babbittian, and that the transformation of Detective Blake is also very Babbittian. And what I mean by that is that those Batman movies, that Batman trilogy, is a lot about the relationship between rules and the good, and to what extent must we conform to rules. And what Batman and Commissioner Gordon greatly understand is to defeat the corruption, and maybe not defeat it completely, but to limit the corruption in Gotham, it is necessary at times to go outside of the rules. That the rules are themselves merely a suggestion. They are the beginning of an attempt to try and comport to the good. But until we are in particular circumstances, it's not always clear what the good requires of us. The one is found, the universal is found in particularity, or as Babbitt would say, life presents a oneness that is always changing. This relationship between things like forms and the decisions that we have to make in the concrete world of conduct is something introduced in the Western world at least as early as Plato, especially in his Republic, when he gave us what's often referred to as the anthropological principle, the relationship between the soul and the city. And Babbitt's political theory, expressed in Democracy and Leadership, is a continuation of that Platonic tradition, which of course also has differences with Plato. You will also find similarities in Babbitt and Alexis de Tocqueville. Both de Tocqueville and Babbitt believed that democracy requires the leadership of aristocrats, and aristocrats of a certain type. Babbitt focused on what we might call men and women of character, men and women who comply to internal standards of virtue that make them fit to be leaders in a constitutional system of government. Matt mentioned that I would probably say something about the fact that democracy comes in different varieties. And Babbitt in Democracy and Leadership talks a great deal about a Rousseauistic variety of democracy that tends to push toward direct democracy. That is, a mere giving in to the momentary will of the people. And that form of democracy is very different than something like that which the American framers created in the 18th century. And that is a constitutional democracy. And what is it that characterizes a constitutional democracy? It is the checks and restraints and limitations on power. Think, for example, about one of the foundations for the American system of government. It is the separation of powers. The separation of power into different branches of government, even within a branch of government. The American Congress is divided into two parts. It's the separation of power between different levels of government, the national government as well as the state and local governments. Why is power separated in the American system of government? To weaken it, to protect it, to ensure that what Lord Acton was talking about, and that is the corrupting effect of absolute power, will not occur. So these American principles of limited government, separated powers, checks and balances, representation itself, are all intended to check the lower inclinations of individuals and also to ensure that they work together in a system that John C. Calhoun called concurrent democracy, that they work together to try and not only deliberate, but to compromise with one another, the assumption being that no one group or individual has a monopoly on the good. Just a couple more points. Ethical standards, from Babbitt's view, are not abstractions. They are the consequences of ordering the will, and ordering the will to humanistic or religious discipline. Now, most of Babbitt's work is about the former and not the latter. Leaders who have the ethical disposition that can function well in a constitutional system of government do so because there is a similarity between the two things. What Babbitt saw in the inner life of human beings is an ethical veto power. And he also saw in the American constitutional system, in the system of checks and balances, something very similar in, say, judicial review, that there's a veto power that is placed on individuals who are trying to exert their will within a political system. And finally, when Babbitt searches for examples, exemplars of individuals who possess the kind of character that makes constitutional system work in the United States, first and foremost, he pointed to George Washington, whose rules of civility and decent behavior have already been mentioned. And one of the things perhaps that's most noteworthy about Washington is that he was willing to do what many contemporary politicians find very difficult to do, and that is to give up power, to not be anxious to gain it in the first place, and to give it up when it is still present to them. So with those comments, I look forward to your questions, and hopefully we'll have enough time on the panel for them. Thank you.
You can all hear me? Okay, I'm going to talk about Nietzsche. This is going to be a fairly compressed version of the argument I present in the chapter, and I will say that this presentation presupposes maybe a certain degree of familiarity with Nietzsche's texts. So, in the first essay of The Genealogy of Morals, Nietzsche writes that, quote, "the diminution and leveling of European man constitutes our greatest danger." In Beyond Good and Evil, he writes that the psychological forces manifest in the democratic movement aim at, quote, "an abased, more specifically, a diminished form of humanity, a mediocritization and depreciation of humanity." And again, in The Genealogy, Nietzsche writes that we no longer have anything left to fear in man. The maggot is swarming in the foreground. The tame man, the hopelessly mediocre and insipid man, has already learned to feel himself as the goal and zenith, as the meaning of history, as higher man. Nietzsche claims that, quote, "the total degeneration of humanity, down to what today's socialist fools and nitwits see as their man of the future, is very possible." And precisely because it is possible, Nietzsche attacks the metaphysical, religious, moral, and political principles that he identifies as having led to this condition. So for Nietzsche, the danger with which he is concerned is not the result of merely cultural or psychological forces. Rather, he roots the human predicament in biology and physiology, albeit not in any crude sense, denying that there is a permanent and fixed human nature. Zarathustra reminds us that the human species is a process. You have made your way from worm to man, and much in you is still worm. Once you were apes, and even now, a man is still more ape than any ape. Nietzsche's hoped-for future humanity will view our contemporaries and ourselves as, quote, "a laughingstock or a painful embarrassment." Throughout Beyond Good and Evil, Nietzsche emphasizes the embodied physicality of the human being. When populations mix, different drives and affects, including some which are opposed to each other, also mix. Due to this multiplicity of lineages, there arises a multiplicity of drives competing and conflicting with each other. For most people, Nietzsche suggests, the strongest desire is simply for an end to this interior war. Happiness to the many appears to be rest. Now, how does all this manifest politically? In Zarathustra, we see Zarathustra press the theme that had emerged in Beyond Good and Evil's discussion of herd morality. There, he lambasts the hypocrisy of the rulers. These embodiments of herd morality cannot even bring themselves to admit that they rule. Rather, they want, quote, that no one harm them. There's an explicit link between Zarathustra's discussion and the discussion in Beyond Good and Evil. Zarathustra notes that they cannot even punish the criminal because, quote, they lack fists. Their fingers do not know how to form into fists. They want to, quote, beat everyone to it by doing them a good deed, which is to say they seek to avoid being harmed by fostering a sense of indebtedness in those who might harm them. They've been tamed by their so-called virtue, says Zarathustra, and call it moderation. But Zarathustra, more honest than they, calls it mediocrity. They bite at him not because he finds their small virtues appropriate to small people, a position perfectly consonant with Nietzsche's own moral pluralism, but because Zarathustra finds it, quote, hard to grasp that small people are necessary. This, by the by, is what Zarathustra must overcome. Elsewhere, Zarathustra describes the tarantulas as motivated by revenge. The justice of the tarantula, he says, is revenge. They want, quote, to exact revenge and heap insults on all whose equals they are not. The will to equality is their virtue, so Zarathustra sees through it to what it really is, saying, quote, the tyrant's madness of impotence cries thus out of you for equality. Your secret tyrant's cravings mask themselves in your words of virtue. So the tarantulas make war on all that is high, rare, strange, and different. Quote, they were formerly the best world slanderers and burners of heretics. They are levelers who drag the high down to their level. The tarantulas are the opponents of all possible aristoi, egalitarian deniers who reject human difference. Zarathustra's justice recognizes inequality and allows human beings to be and become what they are. Quote, thus justice speaks to me. Humans are not equal, declares Zarathustra, and they shouldn't become so either. The tarantulas build what he calls their lie-hole lairs on the ruins of ancient greatness, and they try to disguise their revenge as a teaching on life and virtue. So what sort of political or social order characterizes the rule of the tarantulas? In Zarathustra's speech on the new idol, he tells us it is the state. This speech is crucial for grasping Nietzsche's political teaching. He's critiquing the Hegelian and post-Hegelian conception of the state. Zarathustra begins his speech by drawing a distinction between peoples and herds on the one hand and states on the other. Where Zarathustra and his brothers live, there are states. Rather than being a people or a herd, Zarathustra says the state is, quote, the death of all peoples and the coldest of all cold monsters. It lies in claiming that it is the people. Peoples are the works of creators, i.e. legislators, philosophic or otherwise, who establish ways of life and tables of value. Founders, says Zarathustra, serve life and create peoples by placing, quote, a faith and a love over them. The state does neither of these things. Rather, it is characterized by, quote, the will to death, and it, quote, beckons the creatures of death. Peoples have their own tongues of good and evil because they are characterized by different tables of value, while the state, quote, lies in all the tongues of good and evil, presenting itself as universal. Zarathustra recognizes the danger the state poses to the natural aristoi. Quote, even to you, you great souls, it whispers its dark lies. It detects the rich hearts who gladly squander themselves. It also detects you, you vanquishers of the old god. You grew weary in battle, and now your weariness still serves the new idol. It wants to gather heroes and honorable men around itself, this new idol. Gladly it suns itself in the sunshine of your good consciences, the cold monster. Finally, Zarathustra says, it wants to give you everything if you worship it. The state seduces the virtue of the best. It tempts the noble such that they can become the object of all their ambitions. But in pursuing greatness in the state, the aristoi will only find mediocrity and dissatisfaction. The organs of government are rarely populated with the noble and virtuous. These honorable men and would-be heroes, having been seduced to place all their ambitions in the state, are transformed into what Zarathustra calls swift monkeys, clamoring over one another for power. This is an agonistic competition, surely, but it is an agonism in service of the state's ends, not the high or the noble. And as Zarathustra notes, what they really do is drag each other down into the mud. Interestingly, Nietzsche's concern for the power of the state to seduce the best among humanity is shared by Thomas Jefferson. In a letter to David Rittenhouse, Jefferson writes that there is an order of geniuses above the obligations of politics and government, and therefore exempted from it. Nobody can conceive that nature ever intended to throw away a Newton upon the occupations of a crown. Cooperating with nature in her ordinary economy, we should dispose of and employ the geniuses of men according to their several orders and degrees. Are those powers, then, which being intended for the erudition of the world, like air and light, the world's common property, to be taken from their proper pursuit to do the commonplace drudgery of governing a single state, a work which may be executed by men of an ordinary stature, such as are always and everywhere to be found? The universal and homogeneous state is the lie-hole lair of the tarantula. The tarantulas themselves are incompatible with justice as letting things be what they are, because they intend a universal leveling. Zarathustra's convalescence is the point at which he enters a truly aristocratic and superior consciousness by overcoming his pity. He has overcome his abysmal thought and become just in that he can let things be what they are. The high can be the high, and the low can be the low. Rather than being a hard-hearted thing, his overcoming of pity is the most gentle and tolerant. It will not place excessive moral demands on the low, who as such could not meet these demands. It will allow them to be what they are, as well as allowing the high to be what they are. There is no chopping of tall stalks in Zarathustra's envisioned aristocracy. What does this mean politically? Ultimately, Nietzsche's solution to the problem of nihilism, of which the tarantulas are a manifestation, lies in an understanding of three specific elements of his thought: how he conceives of the philosopher as a type and philosophy as an activity, what he means by values, and lastly, the intention behind the teaching of the eternal recurrence. Nietzsche writes, genuine philosophers are commanders and legislators. They say, thus it shall be. They determine the whither and for what of man, and in so doing have at their disposal the preliminary labor of all philosophical laborers, all who have overcome the past. With a creative hand, they reach for the future. All that is and has been becomes a means for them, an instrument, a hammer. Their knowing is creating. Their creating is a legislation. Their will to truth is will to power. So to say the philosopher is a commander and legislator is simply put to say that for Nietzsche, the philosopher is the one who creates values and establishes horizons. As an example, one can consider Aristotle. Aristotle's determination of being stands, even today, at the beginning of the sciences. And even today, the science that thinks it has transcended Aristotle is still ultimately grounded in and responsive to his categories and arguments. As Heidegger notes, the essential definition of truth since Plato and Aristotle dominates not only the whole of Western thought, but the history of Western man in general, down to his everyday doings and ordinary opinions and representations. His point is that over two millennia later, our encounter with the world is still mediated through terms derived from Plato and Aristotle. The Nietzschean philosopher gives order to the chaotic flux of the world and arbitrates what is possible, not merely in terms of morality and politics, but even in terms of the sciences. As commander and legislator, he establishes a way of life and a world. The cosmos, in reality, he writes, is for all eternity chaos, not in the sense of a lack of necessity, but of a lack of order organization, form, beauty, wisdom, and whatever else our aesthetic anthropomorphisms are called. The philosopher's commander and legislator is the source of order, beauty, and these other aesthetic anthropomorphisms that make life livable and meaningful for the many. For Nietzsche, the fundamental danger faced by humanity is that the spirit of revenge, embodied by the tarantulas, has come to dominate the world. The Christian Platonic transvaluation of values, while nevertheless deepening the spirit, established the conditions under which the tarantula's own values could come to rule. His solution is yet another transvaluation of values, to be accomplished via the means of the eternal recurrence. A common misreading of Nietzsche is that the transvaluation of values is what allows us to affirm the eternal recurrence, but this is precisely backwards. The eternal recurrence is meant to function in the same manner as religion, according to Part 3 of Beyond Good and Evil functions. It is a doctrine meant to transform and beautify the human being, and as such, it is a means of what Nietzsche calls disciplining and breeding. In other words, the eternal recurrence is meant to be the content of a new philosophical legislation, and the transvaluation of values is the consequence. The eternal recurrence entails, as a moral condition, the affirmation of the different types, high and low, past and present and future. This project of breeding is not itself teleological, except insofar as a purpose is imposed by the philosopher. It is akin to Darwinian evolution in the sense that this project of breeding and cultivation is grounded in adaptation, or what Nietzsche sometimes refers to as the plastic power. It is distinct from Darwinian evolution in that the adaptive power will be adapting itself to external conditions, including epistemological or hermeneutic conditions established by the philosopher. Philosophic legislators will not shape the individual directly, but will instead shape the conditions to which the adaptive or plastic power responds. Practically speaking, the philosopher rules via the enaction of new categories of being, and values emerge adaptively in response to these categories. This is ultimately a poetic procedure. On this account, philosophy bottoms out in poetry insofar as it is a creative act imposing a meaning and order onto chaos. The world as it is in itself is a chaos, inhospitable to humanity, while the world of any concern to us is a product of a philosophical will to power manifested in a poetic and creative act telling human beings what they must be and what the world is. Yet this philosophic legislator does not act alone, and in a sense has auxiliaries or adjutants. They are something like what Philip Reeve calls the officer class, or perhaps better, they are scientists of philosophy, such as Hegel, Kant, and others, who repress and reformulate the positing of values by the true philosophers. Nietzsche himself speaks of, quote, those who want to ascertain a complex fact of evaluations, in distinction to those who are, quote, legislators of such evaluations. These latter are, quote, commanders. They say, thus it shall be, and in doing so, give to humanity a goal and an understanding of the world. Philosophers are, quote, those who make the most extreme efforts to test how far man could elevate himself. The true philosopher, says Nietzsche, is, quote, a Caesar-like man who cultivates and breeds the brutal man of culture, while this other sort is a tool, a piece of slave, although without a doubt the most sublime type of slave, but nothing in himself. Those of us in academia are the second type, to be sure. Political rule is neither necessary nor desirable for Nietzsche's higher types, as the rest of the speech on the new idol emphasizes. Nietzsche aims at the preservation of the conditions for aristocracy and even at the establishment of an aristocratic rule, but such an aristocracy need not be a literal aristocracy. The rule of the philosophers is a much subtler rule, and those ruled may be slaves of the philosopher, but not in any crude sense. One of the most insightful writers on Nietzsche sums it up well. The late Lawrence Lampert writes, quote, it belongs to our species to live enslaved to truths or opinions that define the horizon within which life is experienced. Such slavery, he says, is natural and insurmountable. Nietzsche is an aristocrat in that he advocates the rule of those superior in terms of wisdom and virtue, i.e. the philosophers. But such a rule need not necessarily require traditional aristocratic social forms. Such rule establishes the horizons in which human beings live, and if Nietzsche's own project of philosophic legislation is successful, the new horizon he aims at will allow all beings, the high and the low, to be what they are, including the aristoi. That's it.
You've been listening to The Sower, a podcast of the Ciceronian Society. If you've enjoyed this conversation, we hope you'll consider signing up for our newsletter and joining us for a future event. We'll be having our 2026 conference at Creighton University in Omaha, Nebraska, the 12th through the 14th of March. And we hope you'll consider joining us for what is always a fine time. Be sure to rate and review this podcast, share it with your friends, and check out our website, ciceroniansociety.org. Thank you for listening.